a special Labor Day edition of the Noon Report. This summer, we've explored a variety of staycation destinations, each one fairly close to home that won't break the bank. Come along as we revisit a few of those locations in New York and Pennsylvania. First, we journey up, up and away to the National Soaring Museum in Elmira, New York. Executive Director Trafford Doherty tells us how an air glider or sailplane is different from a traditional airplane.
A glider and a sailplane, technically the same thing. They are a motorless aircraft in the eyes of the Federal Aviation Administration. In other words, any aircraft without an engine is a glider or a sailplane. The term sailplane came into being in about 1930 when a fellow out west was designing gliders that would stay aloft on the air currents. That's what soaring actually is, staying aloft on rising air coming up either a ridge or rising warm air, which we call thermals, bubbling up off hot parking lots or factories or plowed fields. That air is rising in such a strong fashion, it'll actually buoy the glider up and it'll go up with it. And you can go for many miles hopping from what we call thermal to thermal. They're all really technically gliders, but a sailplane is designed to soar on the air currents and remain aloft for extended periods.
Wow, and so there's no sort of battery or any kind of power used even for takeoff?
Now, normally for takeoff with a sailplane or glider, you're either towed by another airplane called a tow plane. It could be a regular Piper Super Cub, or we have here modified old crop dusters, and they literally tow the gliders up with a 200-foot rope. And you can go anywhere from 1,000 to 3,000 feet above Harris Hill. The glider releases from the rope, and then you're free to slowly glide back down, which takes about 20 minutes, or you can work some thermals and stay up for hours. But normally the fashion for getting a glider aloft today is using a tow plane. You can, in some instances, actually use a car. Or there's also a thing called a winch, which reels in cable, like a big fishing reel, and that'll get a glider up to it.
What sure. Unique experience, Trafford, will visitors get when visiting the National Soaring Museum?
Well, they get up close and personal with the gliders. You see how they go together and all this sort of thing, and there's lots of things to read and see in the museum. And a few other things, too, I threw in just for interest, things like dollhouses and things of that nature, which are interesting for people generally. But we basically are about sailplanes and gliding here, and we have a large collection. You know, we're 30 gliders on display in this museum.
And the crafts are not only from the United States, right?
No, we have a number of sailplanes here from Germany. The sport of soaring really originated in Germany. In 1919, the Treaty of Versailles forbid the German people from having powered aircraft. Of course, during World War I, they led the world in their technology and airplanes and their fighter planes and bombers and things. So they started developing sailplanes and gliding as a sport, and they really went to town on it. I should say one thing, however. The first soaring flight ever made in the world was done here in 1911 by Orville Wright. That year, he came back to Kitty Hawk and took a modified biplane, did some changes, brought it back as a glider. He wanted to see if he could actually stay aloft on the rising wind coming up the slope at Kitty Hawk, where they experimented before, you know, the first flight in 1903. And he was able to stay up for almost 10 minutes. That was the first soaring flight in the world.
We're visiting the National Soaring Museum in Elmira, New York.
Our purpose is to educate the public about soaring, what soaring actually is, and also the history of it in this area. Elmira is considered the soaring capital of the United States, and that's because in 1930 it was selected as the official contest site by the then National Glider Association, the NGA. And the first national soaring contest was held here in September of 1930. These flight sites, and there were several of them around this area, were selected because the topography of the land, there are ridges facing any direction of the compass, so no matter if there's wind blowing from any direction, there's a ridge around Elmira somewhere where folks can ridge soar, you know, on the up-thrusting wind coming along. Now, in 1934, the county purchased and acquired the land that was to become Harris Hill, kind of in the middle of the area, and created an 1,800-foot long runway here. So all of a sudden, you could do car tows and winch tows, and later on, airplane tows. So this instantly became the preferred site from all the others because it's so more flexible.
Trafford, does the Soaring Museum have any special events on tap for this summer?
We do, as a matter of fact. We have the International Vintage Sailplane Meet, July 10th through July 17th. It's a week long. And these guys fly these sailplanes. The weather's nice. We'll be flying every day. If you watch a contest, they take off and they disappear for several hours. With the vintage sailplane meet, you get to watch these old-fashioned gliders from the 1930s up to probably the 70s. They take off and fly around and land again, so it's a great spectator sport.
Excellent. And what does it cost to come and enjoy the Soaring Museum in Elmira?
$9 for an adult, $8 for a senior, that's 60 and older, and youth ages 7 through 18, $5, and 6 and under free. And we have a family rate of $25 for two adults and two youth age children or more. So we keep it affordable.
And where can people go to learn more?
We have our website, soaringmuseum.org.
That's Director Trafford Dougherty with the National Soaring Museum in Elmira, New York. Next, we head south to eastern Pennsylvania near Kutztown for a glimpse of the historic Crystal Cave.
My name is Jim DeLong, and I am the president of Crystal Cave.
So, Jim, you're located in Kutztown. For folks who may be coming from New York State or western Pennsylvania, just give us a ballpark idea where that is.
Kutztown is basically located between Reading and Allentown in Pennsylvania from New York City or so. It's about a two-hour drive.
So tell us a little bit about the Crystal Cave. It's called the Historic Crystal Cave. I cannot imagine finding a cave in your backyard. What's the story behind it?
It was discovered by two farmers in 1871 that were blasting for limestone to fertilize their fields, and they blew a hole open in the side of our hill here, and Crystal Cave was discovered at that point.
Do you have any dimensions, or like how big of an area is it? Is there water in this cave?
It is a living cave, which means that it does get dripping water from the surface from rain and snow and things like that as it melts and seeps through the earth down to the cave. So it is a living cave. We don't have any real big bodies of water in there or a river or anything like that. Our biggest body of water we call Lake Inferior. It holds about 3.5 quarts of water, but it's really pretty. So there is no water in it, but the dimensions of the cave, it's about 500 feet back from the opening as like a crow flies, or about 125 feet down as the deepest part of the cave from the surface of the earth.
So there are stairs, so it's not wheelchair accessible, right?
That is correct. It is handicap accessible if you can walk. There are 211 steps throughout the cave at different points and intervals, all with hand railings, and we do have safety netting on the sides of the stairs as well, so little children are safe. We never had a problem with that. But it's not accessible to wheelchairs or baby strollers because it's just too hard to maneuver through there with the amount of steps we have.
This feels like a vast cavern.
It is. It's a nice cavern. It's the oldest operating cavern or cave in the state of Pennsylvania and one of the oldest in the whole entire country.
Now, the main reason to come here, obviously, is the historic cave, but you also offer several other attractions in one place.
Yes, we do. Seasonally, we have an 18-hole miniature golf course. We also have an ice cream parlor, which serves hot food right now. Normally, in the summer, we'll have a restaurant open, too, but that's not open at this time of year just because of COVID and lack of employees. We also have panning for gemstones, where you can buy a bag of sand and pan them out and keep whatever you find. You're guaranteed to find quite a bit, and that's a huge hit. We have a nature trail, which is 5/8 of a mile walk through the woods with a path cut through. It's very easy to maneuver and almost impossible to get lost. And we also have a gift shop, you know, lots of different gems and minerals and just souvenirs. And seasonally also we have another gift shop open, which is called our Trading Post, and that also has a museum in it with things dating back to the late 1800s and early 1900s.
So it's a great place to learn a little bit more about this area of Pennsylvania. How much does it cost for visitors to come and explore?
To get in, anyone 12 years old and older is $17. Children 4 through 11 are $13, and 3 years and younger are free.
And that includes all of the attractions, right, Jim?
Miniature golf and, you know, obviously the ice cream parlor, food, the restaurant, panning for gems and anything in a gift shop are extra charges. But the parking's free, the use of our nature trail's free, we have picnic tables, grills you can use.
I was going to ask if you recommend maybe people pack a lunch, but you said picnic tables.
Yeah, we have picnic tables, so you can pack a lunch. A lot of them are undercover, like under trees, or we actually have some under the back of our gift shop. So if it's a little inclement that day, you can sit under there without getting rained on.
Great. Jim, is there anything else you think our listeners need to know about the historic Crystal Cave?
Well, I'd say because summer is our busy time, it is a cool 54 degrees all year round, so it's a great place to come and cool off for an hour. The tour is about an hour in the cave, so you can cool off, and it's just a nice place to be in the summer, you know.
And before making the drive to come here, where can folks learn more online?
Our website is crystalcavepa.com.
Thanks for coming along. That's Jim DeLong, president of Historic Crystal Cave in Kutztown. I'm Family Life's Tracy Lynn, taking you to destinations in our listening area, places available for you to explore even during the COVID pandemic. So program your GPS or grab a map as we track north to the wilds of the Adirondack Mountains. Representing the largest protected area in the 48 U.S. states, the Adirondacks boast more than 2,000 miles of hiking trails. Join us as we stop at the Adirondack Experience. Executive Director David Kahn fills us in on hands-on activities geared for kids at the museum on Blue Mountain Lake.
At the Adirondack Experience, guests can visit our indoor and outdoor attractions. We really offer a lot of things to do in both areas. We have a very large campus with over 20 buildings on it, so there are great exhibits to see on all sorts of topics ranging from boating to logging to the history of people in the Adirondacks. There are also trails on campus that people can take and explore the area around us. One of the trails leads all the way out to a pond where we have a boathouse where people can hop in a canoe or a skiff or a guide boat and get an experience of what that's like on a wonderful secluded Adirondack pond. There are workshops virtually every day where kids can indulge in different activities. And we have special events that we offer over the course of the season, ranging from a crafts fair on July 24th to a Mohawk and Abenaki Art Fair that takes place on the 29th of August. And then in September, one of our great attractions, on September 12th, we hold our annual Rustic Fair, which involves special craftspeople who make all sorts of rustic furniture and frames and anything you could possibly imagine. And that brings in people from all over the country. And then we have a Fall Fest on September the 26th, which is specifically designed for kids. So those are just some of our major events over the course of the season.
Wow, and there's so much to do on a normal day. Where are you located and how many acres do you cover?
Well, the museum is located in Blue Mountain Lake, New York, which is about an hour from Lake George and maybe an hour and 10 minutes from Lake Placid. And from the west, if you're coming from Utica, that would be about an hour and a half or so. So the entire campus includes over 120 acres. And the core museum itself, the 20-some-odd buildings that we have, are located on about 30 acres in the center of that larger piece of land. And the views from here of Blue Mountain Lake are just spectacular. We have a view deck that overlooks the lake. And then this year, for the first time, we're opening another deck, which has been added to our cafe. So visitors can dine al fresco overlooking the lake. It really is a spectacular view.
I'm relaxing already. So when people come here, obviously they need to bring a camera. What else should they bring with them, and how long should they allow?
Well, they should certainly bring the kids when they come. And if you only have an hour, that's fine, but you're not going to be able to see the whole place. Typically, visitors are here for about 4 hours. People do stay for the entire day. There really is an awful lot to see and do. And we have a great big visitor center that adjoins our parking lot, and that has the gift shop and restrooms and all that sort of thing in it. And on occasion, people drive up and they say, oh, I thought that was the Adirondack Experience. And in fact, that's just the gateway. All of the buildings and activities lie beyond that.
David, what is your favorite aspect? I know that's really a hard question, but what is one of your favorite things?
Well, perhaps my very favorite thing of all is the largest exhibit on campus, which is called Life in the Adirondacks. It's 19,000 square feet. That might be a little hard for people to envision, but it's huge. And in there are all sorts of things for people to do, videos to watch, There's a log jam activity where families can break up a log jam. There's a guide boat rowing activity where you can learn how to row a real guide boat across a virtual lake. There's a mine, an iron mine blasting activity where kids can set off a blast in a mine. So there's an awful lot to do in there. And I might also mention we have two special exhibits this year, one on World War II and one on really crazy taxidermy. There's a whole scene of bunnies in a schoolroom. There's a kitten wedding. There's a monkey riding a goat. There are boxing squirrels. It's really wild and must be seen.
Oh, wow. It's wonderful. And I'm sure our listeners would like to be here. So what can you tell us about the prices to get in?
Well, the prices are $20 for adults, $18 for seniors, $15 for children 6 and up, and children 5 and under are free.
That's David Kahn with the Adirondack Experience in Blue Mountain Lake, New York. Next, we set out to take in a few more sights of nature, but these views will be taken in while riding aboard the Oil Creek and Titusville Railroad. Crossing into the Keystone State, we next stop in Titusville, PA. General Manager Sherry Porter shows us around. So, Oil Creek and Titusville Railroad takes visitors through the valley that changed the world. Would you fill us in on the backstory of that phrase?
Sure. We are fortunate enough to be located in the valley where Colonel Edwin L. Drake drilled the first oil well. And our train ride takes you down past the actual site where his original well was, takes you on down through what is referred to as Drake Well Museum and Parklands, and then on down through into Oil Creek State Park, which is where the majority of the oil boom took place around this area. At one point, if you look at the pictures, you will see where everything was clear cut. There was not a tree, a shrub, a bit of green anywhere. We are very fortunate in that nature has reclaimed all of that, and we now have a beautiful forest that we take you down through in a vintage railroad train car, and you get to experience what has changed and the history that was there originally.
Excellent. You alluded to not only the scenery, but the train car. Is there anything unusual about the train itself? And can you tell us more about the train cars?
Train cars are all Pullman cars. Most of them are 1920 to 1940 manufacture dates. So it is an authentic antique train. They have been rehabbed and there's still work to be done, as there is with anything that is owned by a nonprofit. But we work on them along with trying to provide everybody an educational opportunity to see what's out there.
Excellent. And is the train like a steam train or?
It is a diesel engine.
Okay, because steam trains are a lot of work.
They are, yes. So we do occasionally bring some of those in. Hopefully something we can bring back in the future, but it is a costly endeavor. So we have to space it out a little bit.
That's right. Sherry, what sort of special events do you have in the coming days?
This weekend, we will have our speeder cars in for some special runs during Oil Festival here in Titusville. Those are the little maintenance cars that you often see buzzing down the tracks, that type of thing. So we have a group that comes in and brings them in.
I have to ask, because I have that mental picture of a cartoon when I was a kid, you know, the kind, right? Two people, it's like a seesaw, yep. But you're pressing up and down on the bar.
You know, and that is the thought that comes to everybody's mind, okay. But ours are a little more modern than that. These are all each powered by an engine, so nobody's on the seesaw pushing away. These are all a little more technologically advanced, so they do all have motors to them. Some of them are open cars, some of them are enclosed cars. Some seat two people, some seat up to six people, but they will be in town this weekend. The tickets for them are sold out, but it is still a neat experience to see them go by. They will be going out of the station at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning and 6 p.m. Saturday evening. Our regular train ride will go out at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday and Sunday both. We have our murder mystery dinners where we have a troupe that comes in and puts on a play that you see between the station and the train. It's catered by a local caterer. We will be having our fall foliage runs that will run in October, the 1st through the 17th, basically taking you down through the valley while the leaves are changing, and it's a spectacular view.
Absolutely. Well, you have us dreaming of fall leaves and crisp weather. What does a normal voyage cost for those who come on board the Oil Creek and Titusville Railroad?
Adult tickets are $20 each. Seniors over 60 are $18. Children between the ages of 2 and 12 are $14 apiece. First class tickets are $35 apiece. And until the end of September, we have what we refer to as our family special. It gets two adults, two children on board for $50. The train ride itself is 3 hours start to finish. If you're going to spend any time looking around in the station, checking out the other sites in the area, you're going to want to add time to that.
Absolutely. Where can we learn more about you online?
We have both a website at www.octrr.org. And then we can also be found on Facebook at Oil Creek and Titusville Railroad.
That's Sherry Porter, General Manager for the Oil Creek and Titusville Railroad in Titusville, Pennsylvania. I'm Tracy Lynn with Family Life. Today we're spotlighting a few of our 2021 staycation destinations. We started with glider planes, and finally, we take you to the Finger Lakes and the museum that honors the man considered to be the father of U.S. naval aviation, Glenn Curtis.
My name is Rick Leisenring. I am the curator of the Glenn H. Curtis Museum here in Hammondsport, New York.
Rick, we've all heard of Orville and Wilbur Wright, but why is it important to know about Glenn Curtis?
Well, Glenn, being a pioneer aviator and also a developer of lightweight, very powerful aviation engines of the day, contributed probably much more to the development of aviation in the 4 years he was involved personally than Orville and Wilbur did, starting in 1908 when he was working with Alexander Graham Bell and the Aerial Experiment Association here in Hammondsport, New York. On July 4th of that year, he flew the first publicly announced, officially witnessed air flight in the United States.
Yeah, and it was at Keuka Lake.
And that's correct, right here in Hammondsport, and over 2,000 people came to witness the flight.
Neat. For folks that are not in the area, Keuka Lake is the Finger Lake that looks like a Y.
That's correct.
And it's so unique. It's a beautiful area. And is it true that Glenn Curtis had a lot to do with naval aviation?
Absolutely. Glenn realized in those early days that the abundance of flat, unplowed fields to take off and land in for early aircraft was very far and few between, but the area had lots of bodies of water, such as lakes and ponds and wide rivers. So he started developing a water flight system, first by putting a pontoon on an aircraft and turning it into what was called a hydro aeroplane. And from there, he developed flying boats. At that point in 1910, Glenn went to the Navy and talked them into developing their own air wing. And by 1911, he was selling them their first aircraft and training the first naval air pilots.
Wow, we have a lot to be thankful for Glenn. Mm-hmm. Am I accurate in saying that he started with bikes and then motorcycles as far as he progressed with his engines?
Absolutely. Glenn was a champion bicycle rider in the late 1890s. He got married in 1898 at the age of 20, and in 1899 he opened his first bicycle shop. He started designing racing bikes, and from there in 1900, he decided that he needed to go faster and started experimenting with motorcycles. By 1902, he was into commercial production of motorcycles, and he developed the V-twin engine, the twist throttle on handlebars, both of which are still used today. And from there, he just kept progressing. He became the man to go to if you wanted a light, durable, and fast, powerful engine for either a motorbike. And for early aviation, there were aeronauts at that time trying to put engines on their dirigibles or gas bag balloons, as it were.
Wow, he used the need for speed to help others, not just to get a thrill.
Yes, he did. Actually, he did. He was willing to work with anybody and produce anything. As a matter of fact, as a result of working with these aeronauts and their dirigibles, he produced the first V4 engine, and from there, in 1906, produced the first V8 engine. And in January of 1907, having that need for speed, he put the V8 engine on a motorcycle frame, took it to Ormond Beach, and on January 24th, set a world land speed record of 136.4 miles an hour on that motorcycle.
Wow. I know there are a lot of things to see there at the museum. Can you paint a picture of what people can glimpse while they're there?
Okay, the museum is a 57,000 square foot facility. We have 20 full-size aircraft in the building, all related to Curtiss, a large collection of antique automobiles and vintage motorcycles. The exhibits are set up in a chronological order covering Glenn's life from his early bicycle motorcycle days through aviation into land development. He founded the cities of Hialeah, Opa-locka, and Miami Springs down in Florida in the 1920s. Then he got into building and selling travel trailers and then racing motorboats and a wide variety of other interests. We also have a restoration shop where our volunteers are in the process of restoring a P-40 Warhawk.
Wow. Glenn was really quite the Renaissance man, and I know you have some very loyal volunteers that help out there at the museum. So which aspect of the museum most excites you, Rick?
What excites me? Well, having been here for 18 years as the curator and historian, I'm finding out all kinds of new information on Glenn as the digital age releases and opens up new information. And it's amazing what the man did. Sadly, a lot of people aren't aware that he passed away at the age of 52, and at the time he passed away, he was also in the process of designing the first drive-through safari park, which reflected his love of nature, camping, and hunting.
Wow. And do we know where he was aiming to have that?
That was down in Florida.
Okay. Well, makes sense. I was just curious, what do we know about his personality?
Glenn was a shy, introverted person. He loved to work with people, but he did not like crowds. But he was a man of very few words, so it's very hard to find any quotes from him. He was the kind of guy that liked to roll up his sleeves and get out on the floor of the factory and just work with the individuals solving problems. He didn't like to sit in an office and try to run a business.
He was attention to detail man. That's how he made those changes.
Exactly.
Well, tell us how people can learn more about you and then what the price range is for people to come and experience the Glenn Curtiss Museum.
We're located on Route 54, just outside of Hammondsport, and we're open 9 to 5, Monday through Sunday. The hours will change later on this fall, around the 1st of October, to 10 to 4. We have a wide variety of admission rates from adult, senior citizens, 65 and older. We have a veterans admission, and then we also honor AAA at curtissmuseum.org, and Curtiss is spelled with two S's.
That's curator Rick Leisenring with the Glenn Curtiss Museum in Hammondsport, New York. If you'd like to hear more about any of these destinations, you can find a list at familylife.org/podcasts. May you and your loved ones safely enjoy time together today. Thanks for coming along on this special Family Life Holiday Edition of the Noon Report.